leaders will need to decide not only what can and what should be done with artificial intelligence, but equally, if not more importantly, what should not be done by artificial intelligence in terms of the impact on consumers or society in general, or whether it's on employees or other stakeholders. So I think that's going to be a really important aspect, is that moral and ethical judgment.
Hi, I'm Rebecca Tor, and this is the Emerald Podcast Series, research-led conversations about ideas shaping real-world impact. Today, we're exploring a question many leaders are facing. What does leadership look like in the age of AI? As AI speeds up decisions, reshapes responsibilities, and raises new ethical questions, leaders are being asked to think differently about accountability, transparency, and what it means to stay human-centered. To explore this, I'm joined by Dr. Margaret A. Goralski, Professor of Strategy at Quinnipiac University, USA. Dr. Kostya Mynalchev, Senior Lecturer in Sustainable Futures at the University of Exeter Business School in the UK. And Dr. Laura Steele, Reader in Business Ethics and Sustainability Education at Queen's University, Belfast. Join us as we examine how leadership is changing and what today's decision makers can take forward as AI becomes part of everyday organisational life. Hi everyone, and welcome to the Emerald Podcast Series. It's an absolute honour to have you with us today. So thank you for your time, and I'm really excited to find out your thoughts and your insights on this very important topic of leadership in the age of AI. So to kick us off, I'd like to talk about what probably is on everyone's mind, which is the role of the CEO. And obviously, Laura, your work sits at the intersection of ethics, responsibility, sustainability, and technology. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on this. If AI can make faster, more accurate decisions than humans, what's the future role of the CEO?
Oh, that's a great question, Rebecca. And I would agree with you that it's one that is attracting a lot of attention at the minute. I suppose two things immediately come to mind for me. And one really is about that decision-making aspect of a CEO's role. And the other thing would be about the role of a CEO in general. So just reflecting on the decision-making component, it is one of the key aspects of the role of a CEO. And you're absolutely correct in alluding to the fact that AI is going to have a significant impact on that. It will be able to make faster decisions. I would question whether it can make more accurate decisions. It really depends on how you view accuracy and the different components of accuracy. So I think the question really does highlight that speed and accuracy are important. But if we think about what other key considerations form part of decision-making, the ones that come to mind for me are the likes of strategic alignment. So the long-term vision and the strategy of the organisation and really the core organisational values that underpin it. And I think the CEO plays a really important part in shaping those values, setting the tone at the top, as we say, teach business ethics. And sometimes we'll also use the phrase, the fish stinks from the head. So whether that CEO is setting a positive tone or whether they're setting a negative tone within the organization. Some of the things I also think about is the human CEO has the capacity to really acknowledge and demonstrate awareness of the impact on stakeholders, whether that's your employees, your customers, your investors, partners, and regulators as well. So I think this can be somewhere where AI can identify those stakeholders, but I believe the CEO that is human has the edge in terms of being able to identify and respond to their needs. Some other things that come to mind for me are really around execution and follow through. So even the very best decisions, the fastest and most accurate decisions, to use the wording of the question, they really have very little value without clear communication, if they're not aligned with incentives within the organisation, and they're also subject to ongoing monitoring and adjustment. So that again, I think, is somewhere the human CEO can really excel. This was the final point to highlight in terms of decision making, and it's something I suspect that we're going to come back to during the podcast, is around accountability and ownership. So taking account for and accountability for outcomes and learning lessons, and both in terms of successes and failures. And it's about whether AI can do that to the same extent as the human CEO. a few studies that I have come across recently, which I think help us to understand this quite well. So back in 2019, there was a study by Peter Harms and Guo Hong Han. They published a paper arguing that of the 14 core functions of leadership, which were identified by Gary Yuckel, which include things like planning and organizing, clarifying objectives, problem solving, and so forth, they argue that only three, specifically networking, representing the organization and envisaging change, are not in immediate danger of being automated. So I think that's quite a provocative piece that they publish, and it's probably a driving force behind some of the discussions that we've been having recently around the role of the CEO. But interestingly, there's a study that came out in 2024 by a team at Cambridge Judge Business School, and they find that generative AI, and so obviously if you are aware of the dates there, you'll know that 2019 precedes the launch of ChatGPT and the real rise in generative artificial intelligence, and the 2024 study takes account of that, and they find that generative AI had the potential to significantly outperform human CEOs in data-driven tasks such as product design and in marketing. But interestingly, it faltered when it encountered unpredictable or so-called black swan events. So when we're getting into situations that are novel or ambiguous, this is where artificial intelligence tends to struggle. And we know that across the board. So essentially what we have in terms of the evidence at the moment is that artificial intelligence is going to significantly reshape the role of the CEO. It's going to de-emphasize some skills, the likes of those data and harder skills, but it's probably going to really increase the importance of others, softer skills, and the capacity to deal with those novel and ambiguous events. So in essence, change is coming. It is already on its way for CEOs. And as a result, it's really important for them to understand what leadership in the age of AI looks like.
I mean, it's absolutely fascinating to sort of see what's actually going to be impacted. And you do think the role of relationships, you know, within the sort of like the three skills that really stand out, you know, networking and representing the company. But yeah, the role of being a human, essentially having that relationships and understanding people and, you know, what difference that can make, you know, being a characteristic of leadership. I don't know if anyone's got any other thoughts.
So I was just going to add to that, that I think the role of the CEO is definitely going to evolve. And CEOs in that long-term vision will more define the culture and ensure ethical alignment with the organization. And they may even have to become storytellers, inspiring stakeholders and articulating why the organization exists beyond profit. So perhaps most importantly, trust and influence will remain human traits, with CEOs focusing on building those relationships that you talked about, but also their role will require emotional intelligence and diplomacy.
I really like this, Margaret. I really like it. And Laura, I love the idea that those skills that are truly human and networking being one of them remain into the realm of the humanity of the CEO. And I'm wondering whether it's this humanity, which is by definition inherently imperfect, is what allows us to connect with each other and what allows us to see ourselves represented in by our managers. And we talked about empathy. I wonder if it's this ability to create common meanings, shared meanings, that CEOs would be particularly important for, so that they can see the direction where the AI is good at analyzing, predicting what might come next, but as you mentioned, not so good in responding in a creative or curious way to those black swan events. So it's kind of this human playfulness and ability to stay engaged with each other in the present time, rather than atomized and segmented people in front of a screen, that will keep us in the same organization following a leader.
It's very exciting to think, you know, what AI is going to do for the CEO and for the organization. However, there is always another side to it, a bit of a darker side potentially. So I was wondering if we could sort of dig into the consequences of AI decisions, particularly for a CEO, sort of staying with that leadership responsibility. So should leaders be held accountable for the unintended consequences of AI systems they deploy? Or is there a get out? I mean, Laura, could I come to you again?
Absolutely. Well, I think that's a very topical question because I was looking yesterday at the 2026 World Economic Forum Global Risk Report. An interesting number 8 on the list in terms of global risks that was identified was adverse outcomes from AI technologies. And all of the data that we're seeing is that, as you would probably expect, that as AI is becoming more deeply embedded within business and society, we're seeing increasing numbers of adverse events. And what we see in response to that is calls for accountability. And so accountability is a really a major point of discussion within sort of the AI ecosystem at the minute, because these systems can make or certainly shape very high impact decisions, and it's not always clear who is actually responsible. You know, because there are so many people involved and so many organizations involved in how AI is being designed, deployed, and how its outcomes affect different people. And so as a result, being able to assign accountability there can be really challenging. And so just to clarify that when we're talking about accountability, often we can view it in the simple sense as being answerability of various kinds, you know, who must answer for what and to whom. And it is hard to achieve, as I said, within the context of AI. On one side, because of all the different actors involved, but also because of the so-called black box problem that a lot of algorithms, and in particular some of the most powerful and accurate algorithms are opaque in nature. They're those black boxes. So it can be difficult to understand how a particular decision has been reached. And the other side of the coin for accountability is transparency. And so the principle that systems and processes should be accessible to those who are there affecting, whether that's in terms of being understandable or those people having meaningful input into their design. There's a couple of interesting cases that I would like to highlight in terms of the accountability question within artificial intelligence. So there's one that people might have heard of. It's a very high profile one at the moment involving ChatGPT. So the parents of a Californian teenager called Adam Rain have filed a lawsuit against OpenAI and its CEO, its leader, Sam Altman, alleging that their son tragically took his own life in April of 2025 as a result of interactions that he was having with ChatGPT. So his parents have stated that he was having very intensive conversations with ChatGPT over a period of several months. He discussed a method of suicide, and in the transcripts of his conversation with ChatGPT, it seems that it provided advice on whether that method would work and even offered to help him write a suicide note to his parents. So really disturbing what happened. So his parents are there claiming that ChatGPT launched too soon and that there weren't sufficient guardrails built into the system. And an important thing to highlight there is LLMs like this, systems like ChatGPT, they're designed to be agreeable. You know, that the developers of them want you to use them. They want you to spend as much time as possible on their platform. And so in order to do that, they make them highly agreeable. I think if you had ChatGPT was being rude or being obstructive to you, you'd go and find something else. So as a result, they want it to give you answers that you appreciate and that you will feel that you benefit from. And what happened then in Adam's case was that it really endorsed or validated some of the harmful and destructive thoughts that he was having at that time. Interestingly, you know, in the wake of his parents launching that suit, there's been several more lawsuits filed against ChatGPT in California, including one where they allege that it was a suicide coach. As you probably expect, OpenAI and Sam Altman, they're really vigorously defending their actions. And they've said that in cases like Adam Rain's, they're due to misuse of the technology. So from the accountability perspective, they're pushing accountability back to the user and trying to make them take responsibility for it rather than them taking accountability for it. What they have said is that they are developing tools that are going to be more accurately detect and respond to users who are experiencing mental and emotional distress. So that is still unfolding. We don't know what the results of that case are going to be. But even more recently, just in January of 2026, if you're in the UK, I think people might have heard of this case involving the Chief Constable of West Midlands Police, Craig Guildford. So he was subject to really severe criticism whenever an investigation revealed that West Midlands Police Force had made a series of errors in how they gathered and handled intelligence related to a decision to ban Maccabi Tel Aviv football fans from attending a match in 2025. So specifically, West Midlands Police cited a match between Maccabi Tel Aviv and West Ham Football Club as part of their evidence to support the ban. Problem was, the football match never actually took place. It was completely fabricated. So whenever they looked into it, they have claimed that the error arose from a hallucination by Microsoft Copilot. So the person compiling, or the people compiling the report, had been using Microsoft Copilot, and during that process of research, it seems that it scraped some information from the web about this fictitious match. It was included as part of the report, and then it came to light that it was in fact an hallucination. Interestingly, from a leadership perspective, the Chief Constable Craig Guilford initially refused to stand down. He said that he was going to keep his role, and instead he would work to rebuild trust with stakeholders. But eventually the Home Secretary in the UK stated that they'd lost confidence in him as a result of this AI hallucination. His position became untenable, and he had to step down. So they're two interesting cases, but they're really only the tip of the iceberg in terms of what is coming for leaders, for chief executives, across the public, the private and the third sector. And probably we're going to see an avalanche of unintended consequences and many leaders grappling with what to do in situations like this. Do they try to push accountability onto the user, onto the developers of the technology? Do they try and hold their ground and say, I will rebuild trust you, I understand that I have let you down? I think it's going to be an interesting time for CEOs who are navigating these novel circumstances.
Absolutely. Yes. Thank you. Thank you for alerting us, to what's more to come, really. And does anyone have any comments on that?
So I looked at this from a different perspective, and it made me think about accountability for unintended organizational consequences and who is held accountable now for those. So that would be senior leadership, the CEO, directors, the board members. So since organizations must accept liability for adverse, unforeseen results stemming from their actions or development, it would seem reasonable that leaders will be accountable for AI systems that they deploy. And as Laura mentioned, AI accountability is difficult to, because it's, the systems are complex and they have opaque data influence, they have distributed creation, and the lack of traditional human intent. So it would be very difficult to blame AI. And then that leaves leaders accountable again, the same as any organizational flaws that occur.
I really like this, Margaret. Now, I was trying to play this scenario, a hallucination, in an alternative universe where there's no AI, where perhaps it's human error in data collection or in analysis that leads to an erroneous report presented by, to the leader. In that situation, perhaps the leader would still be held accountable, but there'll be some organizational learning that falls, and there'll be some almost stratified accountability where those subordinates down the hierarchy could learn, and there could be measures put in place. And as you say, with AI, the question remains of who learns? How has the organization benefited from the system being trained from the error? There's no human benefit in that sense, no learning, no shared learning that can be taken forward to repair the trust, as you said, Laura, as well. And it's almost this outsourcing of responsibility without knowing the levels of risk and without the guardrails, as you said also, Laura, is quite concerning.
Yeah, absolutely. It's quite interesting that you're saying, who learns, and if it was a different error, if it didn't come from AI. And that sort of brings up like the elements of trust, we trust people, and you can understand there is human error, but you can always sort of trace it back to where that problem happened. With something like this, we are trusting. I mean, I expect people are checking it, you'd think so, but we are just trusting it. We're just trusting it. And to what degrees do we trust it? Are we missing out some checks? Is that where the accountability is? Because are we missing out some of these checks that we would ordinarily do because it's humans doing it? Are we not doing those sorts of checks because it's AI? I don't know. Anyway, let's move on to another question, which is about sort of looking at it from, we were talking a bit about this earlier, about the qualities of a CEO. As AI is going to continue taking on different tasks and it's going to grow, as you said, what qualities are we going to hold on to as leaders? What are those leadership traits that are truly irreplaceable? You've mentioned some of them, but as we put AI more in the forefront, every organization's doing that, what's really going to stand out in those leadership positions?
Well, I think there's a number and there are things that have already been touched upon. So probably the first on my list would be around moral and ethical judgment. I think that's going to be really foundational, as both Margaret and Costa highlighted there, that you know, leaders will need to decide not only what can and what should be done with artificial intelligence, but equally, if not more importantly, what should not be done by artificial intelligence. And especially in domains where there's values in conflict or where there's uncertain consequences of deploying artificial intelligence, whether that is in terms of the impact on consumers or society in general, or whether it's on employees or other stakeholders. So I think that's going to be a really important aspect, is that moral and ethical judgment. Similarly, and again, we've touched upon it around accountability and ownership. And so whenever outcomes really start to impact people's livelihoods, their human rights, their physical safety, organizations are going to need leaders who are willing and able to take responsibility, to explain the decisions that they've made, and to be open to scrutiny and one would hope open to critique and to feedback in regard to it. This was the final one that I will give, because I'm sure Margaret and Costa have thoughts on this as well, are really about sort of sense making under ambiguity. I think that's going to be another really critical trait. So it goes back to the point that I made before about, artificial intelligence really excelling around pattern recognition within quite defined parameters. But leaders, they need to be able to interpret incomplete, contested or novel situations, and also to integrate social, cultural and strategic dimensions that sit outside of the data, and be able to use that to make those high quality decisions that have really ethics at their core.
I'll jump in here because I think this is a really critical question for shaping leadership development in the age of AI. So definitely visionary thinking, because AI cannot create a compelling vision for the future. And then ethical judgment, because leaders must make decisions that balance profit fairness and societal impact. Emotional intelligence that includes empathy and trust building and cultural sensitivity that remain uniquely human. And then also emotional intelligence is needed to inspire teams and manage change and resolve conflicts, and adaptability and learning agility. So leaders must embrace change and learn continuously and be able to pivot their strategies at a moment's notice. And then they must remain curious and open to innovation. And perhaps lastly, relationship building. And we talked about this in the opening. Stakeholder trust depends on human connections and credibility. Leaders act as bridge builders between people and the technology that's being implemented. So human-centric traits like vision, ethics, empathy, adaptability, and creativity will define irreplaceable leadership value.
I absolutely love this. I love this because, again, I was thinking about what it is like to be part of an organization, a modern organization. Appreciate we've got the digital economy. If we go back to an 80s definition of organizations and institutions as complex systems, and some of the work of Nicholas Luhmann on complexity theory discusses organizations as complex systems that are surrounded by meanings. And what do we do with meanings? We communicate them. So I feel that the beautiful, ethical, human profile that both Laura and Margaret have built, I feel that I can only add this level of embodied presence and compassion in there, because I feel that, going back to this idea of communication, this, I think it's the Arabian model, where the argument is that we communicate in so many ways. What we say is a small part of being able to resonate and connect with somebody else. So leaders need to be present. They need to be able to resonate. And I suppose it's their behavior and it's their ability to stay with complexity, to stay with the trouble sometimes of a workplace, of a culture, without necessarily coming up with a picture-perfect solution, but trying to maybe give the platform to others to come up with this visionary solution that you mentioned, Margaret, that AI can produce, and facilitate and orchestrate the voices of others to come up to a shared solution, simply by being there and being human in its glorious imperfection that I hope would be retained by future leaders.
That's so interesting, because I think sometimes it's not the outcome, but the exercise that people go through with their leaders to come up with, you know, whether it's a brand identity or strategic direction or something. That's what it seems like. Sometimes it's just the exercise of bringing those people together and giving people an opportunity to voice whatever they want to say that actually then moves the organization ahead, not necessarily, like you say, the picture perfect sort of solution. But yeah, it's really interesting because you're now going into, obviously this is your expertise, Costa, into the human side of leadership. And you've all mentioned that, you know, it's about what's the difference between the machine and the human, you know, and these attributes are what you're highlighting here. So given your work, Costa, on compassionate AI education and your perspective here, do you think it's ethical for leaders to use AI to monitor employees, like with their productivity, you know, and what's the line? What's the line between insight and surveillance? I mean, this is something that we're all fearing and worrying about. So put you on the spot there.
I love the question, and it has to be such a careful answer not to go into a territory that'd be very difficult to defend. So I will try and start by disaggregating some of the concepts just so I can be completely transparent in the spirit of the preceding conversation in my perceptions and my own positionality to the issue. So the line between insights, between surveillance, and then AI and productivity. So my starting point into this debate is that AI can facilitate and it can bring about patterns, traits, and trends in organizations and in certain behaviors in organizations that are pre-existent. It does not necessarily create them. For all its disruptive capacity, for ChatGPT being the most downloaded app since becoming publicly available in 2022, my argument would be that AI is simply another stage in the evolution of our ability to process data. Manuel Castells has this thesis of the Network Society, and he argues that we're at the current stage of human evolution, where for the first time, we don't produce artifacts through knowledge. In the past, maybe you'd have a master craftsman who'd produce a beautiful figurine or beautiful statue or beautiful painting. But for the first time in human evolution, we put in knowledge and we get more knowledge. We create this layering of knowledge. And because of this, we ourselves are wrapped in knowledge, in metrics, in biometrics, and in data. We have smartwatches, we track our calories perhaps, we measure the liters of water we've drunk during the day. We produce data all the time. Some of this data we share, some of this data allows us to create playlists and to have really good consumer recommendations when we go online after a very long week of marking. Appreciate that I'm probably projecting here a little bit. And some of our data is collected without our explicit knowledge. So London here in the UK is a city that has one of the highest camera to person ratios in the world. It's over surveillance. So insight and surveillance is a difficult balance to and consent to each is a difficult balance, and sometimes it's provided implicitly. And that takes us to the question of whether it's ethical to use this and to use it for a particular purpose. And this is a fascinating debate, because both Laura and Margaret have touched on the point that actually we need to be clear about the ethical frameworks, the kind of perspective that we adopt in order to ascertain. So if we looked at a utilitarian perspective, we would say that, well, what's good, what's ethical is that which brings the greater good for everybody. And on one hand, that could be great because that could lead to beneficial outcomes. On the other hand, that can be taken to extreme totalitarian category, and we can be talking about the gulags of the Soviet Union. So what stands between for me is the human. It's the leader, it's the manager, and it's the purpose for which data is collected. So in 2022, JP Morgan's WADU unit, and the acronym is Workplace Activity Data Utility, it's a unit which is able to track employee behavior online. So anything from messages on Teams to cursor movements, to time, and to keystrokes. That was leaked by the Business Insider, who suggested that this is used for dark surveillance purposes. But at the same time, JP Morgan argued that actually this is done so they can monitor the well-being of employees, where they're actually taking the breaks needed, and whether simply employees are aware of the negative in the impact of screen exposure. And that takes, for me, takes me back to those key traits that Laura and Margaret have discussed. The ethical side is determined by the intentions, the transparency of the purpose. Are employees aware? Have they had the opportunity to give consent to this information being used? Are their voices represented, perhaps through collective representation in trade unions? Is their welfare considered as part of this process? Is the data simply utilized to streamline efficiency and productivity, or is the employee welfare taken into account? And I think the AI, as you saw with Laura's harrowing example of the AI assisting essentially suicide, the AI cannot be held accountable and cannot exercise judgment, moral or otherwise. It has to be the human, and it has to be the collective responsibility of the leadership team, as well as the employees. And for that, we need to have ethical organizations.
Fantastic. Thank you. That was very diplomatic. I like that. I didn't sort of say yes or no to that question. Does anyone else have any thoughts?
So I think, you know, just to add on to what Costa said, you know, what we've seen in the business world is not just tracking keystrokes and screen time or physical movements without consent, but then docking people's pay for not having spent their 40 hours working. So even if somebody is reading, somebody is looking into a contractual agreement, they're not doing keystrokes, they're not having screen time, and so their pay is docked. And they don't know until they get their paycheck. And they don't even know that this surveillance is happening. So those are the things that build distrust of AI, of the whole human team as well, because somebody has given the okay for this to be implemented. And that's where I think you find really angry employees, and then the whole system breaks down.
Yeah, this was one thing that I just wanted to add. So in some writing that I did previously, we looked at the idea of I think it's Jeremy Bentham's panopticon, and this idea of the all-seeing eye, which comes from sort of a design of a prison. And I think one thing that sometimes gets left out of this discussion is that we adapt our behavior if we're aware that we're being surveilled. Obviously, Costa highlighted that sometimes this is overt and sometimes it is covert, but where it is happening overtly, that we do adapt our behavior when we know that we are being surveilled. And again, to go back to Costa's point, you from a utilitarian perspective, if that produces, you know, better behavior and people are more productive and their relationships with their co-workers are more positive, then perhaps there's an argument for that. But if it stifles the natural criticism of the organization, or perhaps pushback against inappropriate behaviors or unethical behaviors, I think that is where it can be worrying, where people are managing and moderating their behavior in a way that is potentially causing them harm, or causing, you know, harm to or others within the organization, or preventing important issues from being addressed. That is where I think another kind of ethical concern would arise for me.
Thank you. I mean, it's such a fascinating discussion. And you think about, you know, there's that whole thing of what is work, because how many of us think about work, you know, in the middle of the night, you might wake up, write stuff down, you know, you're doing your food shop and, you know, driving your car and you're thinking about work. You're on LinkedIn, not on your work computer, but you're on LinkedIn at, you know, your mobile. Is that what's work and what isn't? See, that's another question. But, you know, I think surveillance is very worrying for any employee. But, you know, if it was to make sure someone's, you know, not working over their hours, if it's about that, you know, and there's a worry for people's well-being, you can sort of see where it could be helpful.
If you're interested in conversations like this, the Emerald Podcast series brings together voices from across disciplines to explore ideas shaping our shared future. From the future of work and education to global sustainability and fairness in society. Find all episodes at emeraldgrouppublishing.com/emerald-podcast-series.
We've sort of touched on this next question and sort of sticking with that, you know, ethical tension, so to speak. I mean, AI, we know, can simulate empathy, might not feel it, but it can actually simulate it. And that's the danger in a way, why, you know, you've got some of these court cases. So if AI can simulate empathy as it can, you know, where does that leave a leader? You know, will emotional intelligence still give them a competitive advantage? What do you think, Costa?
I absolutely love the question, and I love the fact that it links with the need for emotional intelligence, which is something that Margaret spoke to as a topic earlier when we talked about leadership. And we have discussed it also with the examples that Laura gave when we talked about leaders being accountable or not for AI hallucinations. And I would like to perhaps throw a curveball, just because I feel that it's a good time for a curveball in the conversation. So I would like to just to start with a couple of stories. So the first story, imagine you are coming home after a long day at work. And my kind of scenario starts with a long day from work. And I apologize again. I think this is perhaps some projections. You're carrying groceries in a bag, in a sustainable bag. So no single-use plastic, but it's a textile bag. And all of a sudden, the handle snaps and all the groceries just spill on the ground. Now, passers-by walk by and they look on this spectacle that has unfolded before their eyes. Now, those who kind of look and say, oh dear, that's sympathy as a human feeling. That's a form of connection. It's pity disguised as a more generous emotion, but it doesn't really help us. It doesn't really help me to know that somebody feels sorry for me. Empathy is good. Empathy is a better emotion because it kind of probably allows the passerby to think, oh, you know, it's happened to me. It really, really sucks. And makes me feel good probably for a moment or two, but my groceries shopping is still on the floor. So the AI could simulate empathy, but I believe leaders should be moving towards compassion. And compassion is a bit like empathy, but it has intent and it has purpose. The compassionate response from a passerby would be to say, where's your car? Or I've got a bag, I can help you with this. And it kind of takes me back to, so if the question is there a place for leadership and can leaders still exhibit emotional intelligence when AI can simulate empathy? I wonder if we need more than the simulation. Now, very early on in her definition of AI, Laura spoke of how AI is agreeable. And I think the terminology was that actually the AI is agreeable and it has agreeableness rather than accountability, because that allows the user to keep going back. But I wonder if we can truly develop compassion when we speak in an echo chamber. I wonder if compassion requires sometimes to look beyond our own ego and our own beliefs and understand that maybe the difficulty in communication or the raised tone of voice or even the unreasonableness in the other person comes not from malice and not from ideological disagreement or massive rift based on beliefs, but from suffering. And that suffering can come in from anything that can happen in the thorny world of the modern workplace, or it could come in from personal circumstances. And it feels to me that unless we have experienced this and been through this, or perhaps have been on the receiving end, we can't be truly compassionate. Because compassion is formed through adversity and in indifference. And I feel that, of course, leadership training could be augmented through AI, where empathy can be developed. But the extra humane step, the emotional intelligence, the ability to exercise ethical judgment, the ability to show compassion, the ability to show critical thinking and curiosity and creativity, all the traits that Margaret and Laura discussed as critical for leaders, that can only be formed relationally and situationally. And I feel that the AI is still not able to live our lives for us. So there is still responsibility for us to develop that part of our skill set.
Fantastic. Thank you. I mean, you've given so much for us to think about, especially that, you know, is compassion the one thing that makes us stand out differently as leaders? I don't know if anyone else has got any thoughts on it.
So I think, you know, humans can adjust empathy in real time based on evolving situations, emotions, and relationships, like Costa referred to. And trust is built on that perceived sincerity of the person who's involved. I think the competitive advantage will come from leaders who combine emotional intelligence with AI literacy, using the technology to inform decisions, but at the same time, maintaining genuine human connections. And so that's a very difficult thing for any leader to balance, but that's where the competitive advantage will come into it.
I'll be honest, I was so engrossed with what Costa and Margaret were saying. I completely agree. What I loved about both of those was, you know, I think Costa was absolutely right to throw that curveball. And I think I'm going to be borrowing Margaret's phrase of being able to kind of pivot in real time, which I think is something that is, you know, a uniquely human trait when it comes to empathy and compassion and the ability to see and respond to the whole person.
And like Costa said, the knowledge of having dropped your own bag in the past, or, you know, you have this buildup of what's important and how to manage things that AI just doesn't have. And you can train it, but it's a training thing. And training is not the same as living.
And to go back to the point, actually, or the example of Adam Rehn, the ChatGPT was demonstrating empathy to him. It was validating the sort of the dark thoughts and the self-harm impulses that he was demonstrating. But it was a really artificial and dark form of empathy that ultimately may have contributed to him taking his own life. So it might have been artificial empathy, but it certainly wasn't true compassion.
And with no knowledge of the situation.
I suppose another thing then, you know, that's coming out, I'm hearing is, you know, experience. I mean, you know, the experience of living, the experience of being a leader, that, you know, there may be, and I'm sure there will be, so many leaders now that they may not have the experience. So instead of being thinking from a human point of view, they may be going on to whatever this AI system is and ask an AI, what should I do in this situation? Not a bad thing. It's another point of view. But is that where it ends? You know, is it just, I don't know what to do. Okay, AI says that, you know, perhaps I should speak to that person on their own. And then you verbatim almost, you know, rehearse that script that AI gives you. I mean, the outcome of that, you know, we've got to get, you know, that critical thinking, where does that go? And I'm sure you're going to talk more about this, but I think that is what, you know, that's the worry, because, and it's not just obviously for leaders, but, you know, as anyone that's got a responsibility for anything, you can turn it over to AI, but it's back to the experience, you know. You have that innate, you know, if you've experienced it, you know what to do straight away. Like you said, Costa, you know, a solution, like, can I help you? You know, can I get a car and help you pick up your shopping or whatever? You know, it's you're motivated, and that's an instinct almost because you've been there.
I really like, just as a thought, Rebecca, and I love the idea of that again, Margaret and Laura have touched on this, the need to be present, to respond as a human being to other human beings, not simply to what they're saying, but maybe with a more holistic awareness of the situation. And there's a very short story. It's a thought experiment that I love, and it can be applied to any situation. But in this state, it's a thought experiment by a philosopher called Frank Jackson, and he formulated it in the early 80s. And it's called Mary in the Black and White Room, and it's about this scientist. It's a color scientist who studies color. And called Mary, who knows everything about the colors in terms of the different nuances, in terms of the way they impact the retina, in terms of the way our brain processes color. But she's never seen color because she lives in a monochrome room. And the argument and the question is, would she learn anything when she sees red for the first time, having researched and studied all aspects of the color red in an abstract and theoretical sense? And I think we could prepare ourselves to an enviable degree of expert level of knowledge working with AI. But until we have the chance to experience, make mistakes, develop our own understanding so then we can share it with others, become storytellers, as Margaret said, I think that human experience, until that is present, we are not leaders. We could be trainee leaders, we could be artificial leaders, but we're not leaders in the truest human sense, leaders who are able to resonate and connect with others.
Thank you. We will move on a little bit in the conversation. And I was wondering if I could come to Margaret next. And you're highlighting, you know, through this you know, how deeply human connection still matters. And from a global and a strategic perspective, Margaret, which is obviously your expertise, is it responsible leadership to, you know, automate jobs in developing economies, for example, where employment is already fragile? Should we be thinking about these issues?
So this is an incredibly important ethical and strategic question because it touches on responsible leadership, global equity, and the unintended consequences of technological progress. Some key ethical considerations include impact on livelihoods, efficiency versus social responsibility, and the global power dynamics. So quite a while ago, I spoke at a conference in China, and I asked this question. And so if we look at cultures like China, India, Mexico, that have a large population, don't have enough jobs for their own employees, where does AI factor into that? But on the other hand, we know that global power dynamics are going to take precedence. No country is going to want to fall behind in this global power of AI advancement. So again, we're back to that very delicate balance. And so is it more important for countries to be powerful and be at the forefront of AI innovation and implementation? Or is it more important for them to give positions to the people in their country? And this is where governments come into the equation. Governments are supposed to be preparing these social safety nets. We keep hearing about, you know, repurposing people into new positions, you know, retraining them, upgrading them in their positions. But are we seeing that happening? Not really. And not all people will fit in that. So are governments building these safety nets for their people or not? And this is something that we're looking at because obviously, if you're having AI take over positions, even entry-level positions that were in the past, jobs that were done by people, then yes, it affects people's livelihoods. When we go shopping, we can choose self-checkout or we can go to a person. You know, when I go to a hotel, I can choose to have my room cleaned or I can choose to be sustainable, which is the way it's put to me, and not have my room cleaned. But these are all jobs that people are not fulfilling anymore. And so it's not inherently unethical to automate, but doing so without mitigating harm in fragile economies is irresponsible. And leaders need to balance that innovation with inclusivity, ensuring technology serves as a tool for progress, but not a displacement of their own people. It's difficult. It's going to be a difficult road for a country to travel.
Thank you. I mean, you're bringing up questions that I think every leader listening to this is going to be sort of reconsidering what their standpoint is, you know, and how many sides there are to, you know, stopping something, doing something, you know, any choices that we make and the impacts that it has beyond the container that it's put in, like you mentioned, sustainability.
We're so attuned to like Amazon and Amazon deliveries and things being quick, using a microwave instead of an oven and waiting for something. And so what do? We say, I'm just going to go to the self-checkout because it's quicker, right? It's quicker. But you're also doing somebody out of a position that they've held in the past and is not being, you know, retrained to do something other than that. And how many people at that self-checkout, how many people are monitoring the self-checkout one? And so these are all jobs that are, you know, being put aside, not to mention, you know, the whole thing of autonomous vehicles, you know, and all the jobs that will replace.
Yeah, I mean, it's very worrying because, I mean, obviously people say, you know, there will be this new wave of jobs that will be created from, you know, and I'm sure there will be at some point, but there's definitely going to be a whole generation of people that are unable to retrain for whatever reason or unable to do whatever job it is, and what happens to them and what burden, in a way, if you want to call it burden, it has on society. And on the flip, because, you know, they still have to be supported in some way, in you hopefully in those economies which do support their people. But obviously there's lots and lots of economies that don't support their people, so or unable to. So yeah, it's very worrying.
I'm reminded, Rebecca, of the Luddites. So the Luddites in the 19th century, the textile workers who were smashing machinery that was brought in through the Industrial Revolution. And the misconception is that the Luddites were technophobes, that they were actually trying to stem the introduction and penetration technology. But no, they were protesting against the pay and terms and conditions of work. And I completely agree with Margaret on this point, that if there were safety nets, if workers who are being replaced by technology were given the opportunity to retrain and to find better employment, better paid employment, we're reminded of SDG 8, Sustainable Development Goal on the access to decent work, then we would have a true symbiotic relationship between innovation, technological innovation, and perhaps sustainable, decent work growth. But if we're removing jobs, and we're reminded that in the UK, for example, we have an hourglass labour market with lots of entry-level jobs and lots of jobs that are high-paid, but not very many progression ladders in between. And if we're removing more jobs in the middle, then we're creating inequality.
Thank you, Kos. That was actually the point that I was going to raise. It's something that deeply concerns me, is around the stepping stone jobs. And we are starting to see some data that, in particular, artificial intelligence is impacting those jobs, so stepping stone jobs. So for example, the likes of an accounting technician or a paralegal. And for many people, especially if they're not from privileged backgrounds, they can be a way into a profession and to a good career over time. But there are also some of the jobs that are more automatable at the moment. And so you can automate a lot of the role of an accounting technician or a paralegal. Those jobs are starting to disappear. And as a result, there's potentially going to be fewer opportunities for people from low income or underprivileged backgrounds who don't have necessarily the, not only the financial capital, but the social and cultural capital to allow them to apply for and avail of those particular jobs. So certainly I would agree with Margaret about sort of concerns about where those jobs are disappearing from and whether it's sort of hollowing out the middle.
And the more worrisome part of that is that if you don't have those entry-level positions and you don't have the mentorship to take people to the next level, then right now humans are being, the human openings, job openings are for facilitating human and AI management, and also for assuring quality of those agentic work systems. But if you're not building that, then how are humans going to know if it's quality or not quality? And so without those entry-level positions and those mentorships bringing you up to where you know what you're doing, where you have the knowledge to oversee the positions, well, then what do you have? So it's a sort of sticky wicket that people aren't necessarily looking at. Well, where are these next steps going to be, and where are they going to take us? And where are these humans who are overseeing the quality going to come from?
Thank you. I mean, the questions that you're raising here are obviously going to have to be answered. Well, hopefully they'll be answered by, you know, whether it's policymakers, but, you know, lots of them are going to be answered, you know, from a corporate sort of leadership point of view. And just to wrap up this conversation, I thought if we could just look ahead a little bit about the next generation of leaders and what that looks like, in terms of they will be leaders that will need to lead teams that include both humans and machines. And so how do we prepare those leaders? Because, you know, it's not innate. It's not something that we've had going for decades. This is very, very new in a lot of ways. Maybe not, you know, you can replicate some things. But I just wondered what your thoughts were. How do we prepare that next generation of leaders?
So I can jump in. I think we have to think differently. and stop emphasizing some of the traditional skills like strategic thinking, decision making, and operational oversight, which are things that AI is increasingly strong in. And we need to prepare the next generation of leaders to work collaboratively with artificial intelligence. We know what AI excels at, data-driven insights, but leaders will need to interpret AI outputs, question the assumptions, and integrate them into broader strategic context. And leaders are going to need to understand how algorithms work, their biases, and their limitations. They're going to have to need ethical oversight and ensure that AI aligns with organizational values and societal norms. And the next generation of leaders will need that those human-centric skills, like emotional intelligence, storytelling, and cultural stewardship. Leaders will act as orchestrators of human AI teams, leveraging technology for efficiency while preserving human creativity and empathy. And perhaps the most important thing is an emphasis on critical thinking about AI outputs, ethical frameworks, and the relationship building that we've been talking about in a tech-driven world. And when I teach human intelligence and artificial intelligence and collaborative partnerships with students, I emphasize that they are going into an AI world. And so they need to know how to form those collaborative partnerships, not see AI as competition, but how can we solve some of the UN SDGs? How can we create social good in combination with AI? And I think that's what the next generation is going to have to embrace and sort of enjoy, if you can think of it as enjoyment.
Thank you very, very much. That's fascinating and absolutely so much for us to think about. Maybe some final words from Costa and Laura?
Well, to really endorse everything that Margaret has said, I'd be in complete agreement. And I suppose for me, fundamentally being ethical, responsible, and sustainable in terms of decision making. And I know Margaret said that part of the strengths of AI is around, you know, its ability to, if not make decisions, to at least suggest and different options. But I think humans retaining, especially control of really important decisions and decisions where there is a significant ethical component. When I'm teaching business ethics, I sometimes say to students that we can often trace back significant ethical failures within organizations to four different factors: greed, speed, laziness, and haziness. So perhaps when, you know, CEOs or leaders are making decisions around artificial intelligence, to really reflect, you know, are they motivated by greed and the potential rewards? Are they making decisions at speed that could result in them not taking account of all of the potential consequences that could arise? Are they hazy in terms of, you know, what they're doing, why they're doing it, and what the outcomes might be? And finally, are they being lazy? Are they taking shortcuts? Are they not putting in the work that needs to be done whenever it comes to integrating AI in an ethical, responsible, and sustainable way?
I wonder if I can add this. Margaret, you presented a list that is more comprehensive than I could. And Laura, you added the depth and the weight of responsibility. And I wondered if I can finish with a quick paragraph. So my son has been reading Fahrenheit 451. And just as a reminder, it's a book about a world where divisive and dividing and different opinions don't exist. Everything which could stand to upset somebody or offend somebody is being burnt, and since the burning point of paper is 451 degrees Fahrenheit, hence the name of Ray Bradbury's book. And there's a paragraph by the fireman chief, who is actually pointist, who leads a squad, a team, who burn books so that nothing exists that can upset people. And this is what he says, and this is a conversation with one of his subordinates who is beginning to get doubt. So he says, the important thing for you to remember, Montag, is that we're the happiness boys, the Dixie duo, you and I and the others. We stand against the small tide of those who want to make everyone unhappy with conflicting theory and thought. And I think future leaders should be prepared to make people unhappy by standing up for the right things, even if the AI consensus and best practice says so. And they should be confident enough in who they are as people, in their own values, to take the responsibilities that they have for the team, for the environment, personally, so that and closely enough so that they can speak for those who don't have a voice and stand up for those who don't have the power to stand, even if it's quite a lonely and upsetting and ultimately conflict-causing undertaking.
That's what leadership is, right?
Thank you very, very much for being with us today. It's been an absolute honour and privilege to hear your insights and your fantastic research. So come back again. We want to hear more. Thank you.
That's all for today's episode. You'll find the full transcript, guest profiles and related research on our website. This episode was produced with the support of our studio partners at This Is Distorted. Thanks to my guests and to you for being part of the conversation. See you next time.